Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour with your new host, Jose Nino. Today is Wednesday, December 4th, 2024. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing real history into accord with the facts. If you haven't already, you can get a sample issue of the Barnes Review in print for $5 anywhere in the United States, just for a limited time. Call 1-800-77-773-9077 toll-free from Monday to Thursday, anytime from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, or email sales@barnesreview.org. Or visit our website at www.barnesreview.com to inquire more about this limited time offer. Hello, everyone. Today, I'm joined by Scott Horton, the director of the Libertarian Institute and editorial director of antiwar.com, the host of Antiwar Radio, and the author of numerous books critical of U.S. foreign policy. How are you today, Scott?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I have to say, the title of your latest book is quite provocative, to say the least. It is Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. Now, this topic has kind of entered like mainstream discussion and then fallen out with like the emergence of like new conflicts, such as like the Middle East, like with Israel, Hamas, and then like Israel, Iran. But now it's back in the spotlight with the incoming Trump administration. And one thing I really like about your book, it's quite lengthy, but it takes a really big picture perspective where this conflict didn't start on February 24th, 2022, when Russia launched its military incursion into Ukraine. And in fact, from what I could gather, it didn't even start with the Euromaidan crisis of 2013-2014. You make the case in the book that its roots actually kind of start with like the dissolution of like the Soviet Union. Could you go into like detail about that?
Sure. So that's right. The book begins at H.W. Bush in the end of the last Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union. And then how that left the Americans. Well, look, let me rewind for your audience. And I'm sure a lot of people are younger and maybe don't really understand. After the Second World War, the communist Soviet Union, the Russian Communist Empire, ruled all of Eastern Europe, all the way to halfway across Germany. And they had some of these states, the closest states were called Soviet republics, like Ukraine, Belarus, and the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. We laugh about that, so-called republics with ironic quotes around them, right under communist totalitarianism. And then you had the Warsaw Pact states, which were not literally part of the Russian Empire, but de facto were, and countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia, Hungary, were completely dominated by the Soviet communists. They had sock puppet regimes and were members of the Warsaw Pact military alliance under Moscow's control. So that's how it lasted from the end of the Second World War in the late 1940s through the end of 1989. And America's policy had been containment of the Soviet Union and China. And that included, of course, the Cold War proxy wars and all the rest. So now it's 1989. The Soviet Union is finally just falling apart for a lot of reasons, but mostly due to the inherent contradictions built into a totalitarian system. And the thing falls apart. And at that point, then the question is, what is going to happen to the American-led NATO military alliance? And for that matter, what is going to happen to essentially the American empire that had been built to contain the Soviet Union around the world? And there was a real debate. It wasn't just our hero, Ron Paul. It was a lot, and for that matter, Pat Buchanan and other, you know, prominent people, but who, you know, might have been considered more on the edge on some of these conversations. But no, it was a mainstream discussion among the most powerful and influential foreign policy thinkers at the time. People like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was known as Mr., you know, intellectual in the U.S. Senate. He was a Democrat, but he's very close to the neoconservative set, although not an official member of them. And he said, maybe we should abolish the CIA and maybe we should bring our troops home from everywhere. Maybe we don't need to have our post-war national security state at all. Soviet Union's gone. We could be free. Pat Buchanan wrote a book called The Republic, Not an Empire, and said, look, the Soviet Union is gone. Ardent cold warrior to the dying day of the Soviet Union. But the next day, Boxing Day, 1991, Soviet Union is gone. And now the American Empire can come home. But those prudent conservatives, you might call them, they lost the argument. And instead, the government won it. And that's, you know, the Republican and Democratic Party leadership and the national security state and their special interests essentially combined to keep the old policy going. And it's easy to focus on the special interests, but a big part of it is the ideas, you know, the real ideology of American empire that says that, look, man, we whooped Hitler and we've been keeping the peace in the world ever since then. And if we were to stop keeping the peace, chaos would break out everywhere. America is like Christopher Reeve, Superman, flying around, solving every problem, warning every bad guy, you better not try it, and doing whatever they can to hold the world down so it doesn't erupt into chaos. And so if you listen to American leaders talk, that's how they talk. The world needs us, and there's no way we would turn our back on them. And they really internalize that kind of thinking. Now, of course, there's a lot of self-justification and a lot of McMansion buying and a lot of the rest that goes along with that. But the ideology of the goodness of America and its missions to help others is really important and central to a lot of this. So even on the most kind of bureaucratic kind of argument about, like, how can we preserve NATO? We got to find something for NATO to do or else we won't have it anymore. It's still built in, because then we might really need it to do something heroic. We gotta, you know what I mean? It's like they still won't admit the self-interestedness in it. It's all essentially for the greater good of mankind to them. And it really helps to justify a lot of the horrible things that they do, quite frankly.
Yeah, I think there, you raise a good point. There is a very thoroughly like embedded American exceptionalism mindset. I've noticed across the entire political class, even amongst so-called America First populists, you still see these residual elements where they just cannot like see a situation where the U.S. loses like base or has to share space abroad with like emerging regional powers. Like they just cannot like get, they're just not willing to rip the band-aid off and admit that there's like actual limits to the U.S.'s like imperial projection abroad. Now, you mentioned H.W. Bush, because I think one thing that is quite intriguing about Bush is that he's almost like an anachronistic figure in foreign policy circles these days, because compared to most people in the foreign policy elites, he was actually kind of a hard-nosed realist on the issues of like dissolving the Soviet Empire. And if I'm not mistaken, if you could clarify this, wasn't he very skeptical of just giving every like constituent republic of the Soviet Union like full autonomy and independence?
Yeah, so this might sound like a contradiction to people, but it's not. You got to have a map of Europe in your head here to show you. So on one hand, yes, you're right. Bush Sr., to his everlasting shame, although really, especially in hindsight, that's true, and it is very easy to take the moral take, but he did try to hold the Soviet Union together, or he certainly told the republics that, hey, we're not encouraging you to break away. We want you to go along with whatever Gorbachev wants you to do. And he gave a speech in Kiev that William Sapphire, the New York Times columnist, called the Chicken Kiev speech, where he warned them. He said, it's not worth it to trade a far-off tyranny for a closer despotism, right? Like, he sounds like Mel Gibson in The Patriot, right? He
gives that. Yeah, that's exactly, yes.
That's what, and in fact, Gibson may have been paraphrasing that speech. I don't know. And he warned them against the dangers of ethnic nationalism and all the problems that that can cause. And it said, essentially, we do not have your back if you declare independence from the Soviet Union. Now, what happened was the communists launched a failed aborted coup d'etat in August of 1991 that blew up in their face. And Yeltsin, who was the new president of the Russian Federation, which was, or it wasn't the Federation yet, but just Russia, that was the largest constituent part of the Soviet Union, of course, and where the capital city was. He faced down the commie coup plotters and they failed. And then, so he brought Gorbachev back, but he brought Gorbachev back to be the leader of nothing. The Soviet Union was then basically dead. Gorbachev's power was dead and all the power was held by Yeltsin. And Yeltsin then made a deal with the leader of Belarus and Ukraine that let's all agree to break up and that'll be the death knell. That'll be it. And they did. And so they heroically then brought the red flag down on Christmas Day, 1991. And that was final kaput for the last of the USSR. But back to H.W. Bush now. H.W. Bush was not interested in wresting Ukraine away from Russia. Ukraine, the way that the Bush senior government talked about Ukraine, it was east of Eastern Europe. They would say, hey, we weren't trying to take Ukraine. We were just trying to liberate Eastern Europe, right? Ukraine is east of that. And then, so they had in mind not even necessarily liberating Ukraine from Soviet rule, much less bringing them into our alliance. They would have never had gone that far. At the same time, however, the Bush government did clearly decide that not only were they going to keep American forces in Europe, especially in Germany, and keep the NATO alliance, they were going to expand it, and they were going to expand it at Russian expense, and they were going to lie to them and get them to believe otherwise. And I got in a debate with Niall Ferguson where I didn't have a chance because of the structure of the thing to really cover my ass on this. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not an academic. I read this in Joshua Schifrinson's work. And now I do cite a lot of documents. I did a lot of firsthand research myself in this. So, you know, you decide on my own, as an author, my degree of speciality. But I cite Schifrinson very politely saying that we can see that as they're saying this to each other in Washington, and they're saying that to the Russians in Moscow, that they're really being deceptive. They're telling the Russians, we're going to make NATO, never mind expansion, it's not even a problem because NATO is going to be a political organization, sort of like the EU plus America. And we're going to replace it as a military alliance. We don't need an alliance anymore because there's no enemy. So now what we're going to do is we're going to have a partnership. We're going to have a joint security arrangement, and you and Ukraine will be part of it together with us. That way, from the very beginning, we'll have essentially ingrained a de facto neutrality for Ukraine. It takes it off the table for being such a contentious piece of territory between East and West. If the Russians lost it, but they haven't, you know, only literally, but figuratively, they haven't really lost anything in their relationship with the country, then it's fine. We can all be part of this thing together. But the thing was, they were lying. And by the way, Jose, when I was younger, this was what me and my friends, this is what we thought was the New World Order, right? Like on the John Birch Society model.
Yeah.
That now that the Soviet Union is gone, America and Russia are going to merge together. We're going to bring them into NATO, and it'll be the one white world army of the North to enforce the UN law. And then next on the chopping block will be Islamic South Asia and then China and whatever. And that was the whole New World Order conspiracy theory of the time. But that wasn't true. I mean, Bill Clinton was like three clicks to the right of any plan to do that. You could call Bill Clinton Dick Cheney. He was not at all a one worlder going along with that. It was always at the Russians' expense. We're going to take the dividing line in Europe. Instead of erasing it, we're moving it east. And you'll hear advocates say repeatedly, yeah, but the Eastern European countries wanted to join. Well, of course they did. They had just finally escaped from Soviet slavery. Yes, they want to run west right into our arms and behind our nation's skirts, right? Of course they do. But does that make sense for the United States that we put what Warsaw and Tallinn want above what's good for the people of you know, Omaha and Austin. Why should we? What was most important for the American people is that we remain on a copacetic relationship with Russia. They're the ones with H-bombs pointed at our head. And we can love Poland, but why do we have to give them a war guarantee where we promise to trade Houston, Texas, or worse, for Warsaw? And, you know, maybe our whole country in a war if it ever came down to it. And basically the answer is that Russia was so weak at the time that everyone said, well, we're afraid of them for like the long term. We want to get into your alliance now. But nobody thought Russia was coming then. They were so weak. And so, but then that meant, well, we can do whatever we want and they're not really going to be able to do anything about it. But as Pat Buchanan put it in his book back then in 1999, that what's happened is Bill Clinton has just scheduled a conflict for the 21st century. We'll see in 20 years, Vlad, when the border war finally breaks out in Ukraine or the Baltics or wherever it is. And that's exactly what has happened is, you know, they set us on this path. And you know what's funny, man, is right before this interview, I just did the Piers Morgan show and they brought in Wesley Clark, the former general. Oh, and I got to go back and forth with Clark for a little bit. And I was not able because, dude, he went on and on calling me, you know, a Hitler apologist and blah, 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 blah. But instead of like, you know, going on too much about that. And there were a lot of things I didn't get to ask him about. But instead of just like accusing him and challenging him, I asked him a question because I have this in my book. Like, don't have a lot about Clark's role in this, just a little. But it was the Pentagon that wanted peace. The section in the book is called Pentagon for Peace instead of Partnership for Peace, because it was actually the Secretary of Defense, William Perry, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, John Shalikashvili, and the Chief of Pentagon Policy Planning, the head of the Joint Staff, General Wesley Clark. They were the ones who were pushing for the Partnership for Peace, where Russia and Ukraine would be members along with everyone else, on equal standing with everyone else. And this is what Clinton was promising the Russians. And then he talks about when, because I ask him about this, and he says, yes, that's true. And he goes on a loop for a minute, and then he comes back to it, and he says, he kept crossing it out. NATO expansion. We're not doing that. Why are we doing that? The Pentagon doesn't want to do NATO expansion. We're not doing that. And then he kept like, Xing it out of the speech, and then whoever's speech, I'm not exactly sure, but then maybe it was Al Gore's speech. And then Al Gore gave the speech and announced NATO expansion. All that stuff we said about the Partnership for Peace, we were just jerking your chain. We needed to get you out of the way. We needed to get you to acquiesce. We needed you to think that we were respecting your wishes for as long as possible before sticking the knife in your back. And Wesley Clark just confirmed all this history to me just now on the other channel, man. So like, you know, that was what happened. And he says now, well, it was because the Russians were so bad that Bill Clinton made the wise decision to do this. And I'm like, yeah, well, are you aware that your boss, William Perry, says that to this day, he regrets that he didn't resign over it, that he regrets that he didn't do every last thing that he could to prevent Bill Clinton from taking us down this path. And look where it left us. And then the hawks are left, Jose, with this circular argument. Well, if we would just give a war guarantee to everyone in the world, then no one would ever fight again because no one would ever mess with us again. But the problem with that is, what if they do? Now you've given a war guarantee to everyone in the world. So it's this very kind of, you know, and in the case of Ukraine, if they had said, say Bush in 08, said, oh, we are absolutely like, never mind a membership action plan. Here's an engraved invitation to join NATO. Then Putin would have invaded the next day to prevent that from ever being signed, to prevent that from ever happening.
Real quick. Sure. Were there any attempts in the 90s or early aughts to incorporate Ukraine into NATO that you're aware of?
They got started, yes, in the late 1990s. They got started on not exactly a membership action plan, but something somewhat close to that as early as 1997. There's a section at the end of H.W. Bush regarding Ukraine, and I know what it was. This was not so much America's role, but it was just showing the danger of what was at stake where Ukraine is breaking away from Russia and declaring independence from the Soviet Union and destroying the Soviet Union in the process. But they're taking this piece of what used to be Russia with them on the borders drawn by Lenin in 21 in what's now called the Donbass, right, in the far east of the country. And there was a period there where Yeltsin's, at least lower down officials, were threatening war with Ukraine over the status of Crimea in the east. And they essentially let that blow over because they thought they would have enough influence in Ukraine to make the point essentially moot, and because they were really trying to suck up to the United States at the time and the West at the time, so they didn't want to force the issue with the Ukrainians. That just goes to show what a touchy issue it was from the very beginning there. And then by 1997, you have the beginning of interoperability and NATO working with the Ukrainian military to get them up to standard with NATO techniques and equipment and so forth, the very first stages of bringing them into NATO. And they held war games on the Crimean Peninsula, simulating an ethnic conflict breaking out. And imagine what that looks like from Moscow. I mean, and thousands of protesters came out, and then they said, oh, no, you know what, let's change it. We're practicing earthquake relief. We're practicing saving you from an earthquake. And I was like, guys, it's kind of already too late what you just already said there. And this is in 97. And this is, you know, right as they're bringing Russia in to the Partnership for Peace, which was, as they put it, an alliance with the alliance. In other words, Russia will never have a say. They'll never really have a seat at the table with NATO. They are too powerful to be brought in. They're not powerful enough to stop us from doing whatever we want. But if we brought them into the alliance, they would have even more power and authority than Germany and like equal to Britain in terms of their power. I mean, they literally control the landmass of all of Northern Asia. They got thousands of hydrogen bombs and massive interests. And the Americans just weren't willing to concede that much decision-making authority to them. So they were never going to get better than a council where they get to meet with NATO and complain and be ignored, you know, beginning in 1997. And then so right as they're doing that, then they hold these war games on Crimea, practicing essentially seizing the peninsula from them, their extremely important naval base at Sevastopol there. So that's, you know, just kicking the whole thing off in the 1990s. And then what really brought it to a head was the W. Bush years was first the Orange Revolution of 2004, where the National Endowment for Democracy spent all this money to do a color-coded revolution, essentially, to prevent the Russian-leaning candidate from winning and possibly to prevent him from rigging the election. But if so, it was only a battle among thieves because the American side was stealing it too. It's like Abdullah versus what's his name in Afghanistan, where they're both just trying to steal it from each other. Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah, they're both trying to kill each other. They're both stuffing ballot boxes. So it was like that. And so America intervened on the pro-Western side. And then at the end of Bush Jr., he offered this sort of pseudo membership action plan to Ukraine, a kind of half step toward membership. It was far short of a war guarantee, but enough to really get the Russians angry and concerned about what was going to be the future relationship between the NATO military alliance and this extremely crucial country right on their border. And so this is what a lot of the scholars at the time, again, like Council on Foreign Relations types, said, well, this is the worst of both worlds, right? You could either be for not giving them a membership action plan of any kind, or you could be for bringing them into NATO. But telling them that, well, here's a half a membership action plan, and we're definitely going to bring you into NATO someday, but we're also definitely not going to do it soon enough to offer you any real protection under our so-called umbrella of treaty alliance. And so we're really just pushing them out there to fight and without any ability or actual intention to protect them. So it's a really horrible move. And you won't be surprised to know that a huge part of why was simply for George W. Bush's own personal reasons. The CIA and the National Intelligence Council, his own staff on the National Security Council, and the CIA and everyone told him, don't do this. It's a huge mistake. The entire embassy in Moscow was against it. This is crazy to do. You're just starting a fight that you can't really help. You're getting these other people into a fight. You're not going to be able to protect them from. But what was the answer? This is a legacy building operation for one man, one weak and stupid and pathetic loser of a man, George W. Bush, whose legacy was supposed to be Iraq War II, but which was an absolute catastrophe. So now he had to figure out something else to do. So he'd go down in history as anything but the worst president since Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt or Harry Truman or Richard Nixon or
LBJ. Yeah.
Son bitch. But so he was trying to do something special for himself, and by building a legacy. And so, and then this, it just led to this absolute catastrophe. And the Germans and the French tried to stop him. And for only one reason: you're going to unnecessarily provoke the Russians. You're not going to actually protect the Ukrainians. They weren't complaining that it cost too much. They love looting their taxpayers too. That ain't it. It was just, why poke Vladimir Putin in the eye? And on your weaker friend's behalf, you're poking him in the eye. It's the wrong thing to do. And look at what it led to. This is as simple as that.
Would you say in hindsight that the Balkan conflicts of the 90s, especially the US, like NATO's intervention there, is what was like the first step that prompted the Russian political class to just say, like, yo, these people in like the US and the collective West are just like total lunatics. We need to start planning for a confrontation further down the line.
Yes. I mean, it's a fact that by the end of 99, the Kosovo War, they were revamping their military doctrines toward, you know, I don't know if it was retargeting Americans, but certainly consolidating nuclear weapons authority again under the president, where it had been devolved to the legislature, I guess, or to a broader concert of military planners or whatever. Ron Paul gave a speech about this in 1999. So one consequence of the Kosovo War, we can see it right now, they've just announced they're consolidating nuclear weapons authority again in the presidency in a way that it hadn't been. And they're, you know, revamping their nuclear doctrines with an eye toward keeping us out. Now, one thing is, in the Balkan Wars were fought in large measure for the purpose not of protecting anybody in Yugoslavia, but in ensconcing American and NATO power as the dominant security force in Europe, preventing the new proposed EU army alliance between Germany and France from becoming the dominant power. We get to drive, and we're staying. And so the Bosnia and eventually Kosovo were both a big part of that. But then, yes, right away, just as they're expanding NATO in the spring of 99, just as they're expanding NATO, they're launching an aggressive war. Like 3 weeks later, they launch a war based on a lie. That, and this is something that, boy, I wish there hadn't been 10 other people on the panel. I would have loved to just squabble with Wesley Clark about this stuff all day, man. That would have been a fun time. They found 3,000 bodies at the end. But TV told me that there are 100,000. Sorry, Bill Clinton and William Cohen, the Secretary of Defense, they said that there were 100,000 Kosovar Albanians had already been genocided and they were going to kill the rest if we didn't get in there and stop them. And this was a lie equivalent to Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program. It was an absolute hoax, what they did there. And in order to launch that war. And then the Russians, of course, absolutely flipped out about it. That here you say, don't worry about NATO expansion. It's a purely defensive alliance. And then in the next breath, you declare war and launch a war and to intervene in a civil war wholly within one sovereign nation state. Kosovo was part of Serbia under all international law. It was dominated by an ethnic minority there, but whatever. It, you know, the Serbs, the Bosnian Serbs didn't have the right to secede from the Bosnian Muslims just because they were an ethnic minority. Hell, they only wanted to stay in their former country, Yugoslavia. Sorry, Charlie. Nope. But when it comes to the Kosovar Albanians, all of a sudden, all those rules are out the window and America's on the other side of the argument. Now we're going to intervene in a civil war to break this province off from who? From the Russia's closest allies in the Balkans, their ethnic and religious kin, the Serbs. By the way, the Serbs who saved American pilots, 500 of them in World War II, and fought against the fascists and the Nazis. They were the good guys in World War II. They were on our side in World War II. And America then turned around and took, you know, after the fall of communism, took the side of the Croatians and the Bosnians, the Bosnian Muslims who had cooperated with Hitler and Mussolini in accomplishing the Holocaust in that country, killing at least tens, I think hundreds of thousands of Jews and Serbs and Romanians and whoever else they're killing in that war, in that country during World War II.
This is kind of interesting as well, because one fixture of the so-called liberal international order is basically the emphasis on territorial integrity and no changing of borders. But that kind of ended, funny enough, to just follow up with the Balkan conflict with Kosovo's like unilateral declaration of independence. I think it was like 07 or 08 if I'm not mistaken. Would you argue that move really set the stage for the conflict in Georgia and also subsequent disputes between Russia and Ukraine later on?
Yes. I mean, this is absolutely part of it. And the Russians warned about it at the time. You're setting a terrible precedent with this. I believe it was Prime Minister Putin complained about it still in 1999 when he was the brand new prime minister in charge of fighting Clinton's jihadist forces in Chechnya, or at least American-backed bin Ladenite fighters in Chechnya. He criticized it then. And yes, this is, and look, I'll put it to you this way, Jose. Henry Kissinger railed against it in Newsweek. You can find this article. It doesn't have his name on it anymore. It just says Newsweek staff or whatever, but you can find elsewhere where people cite it. And that's just a legacy of like link rot and whatever. But there are a lot of articles at Newsweek that don't have the names on them anymore. But if you search parts of it, you can see that it was clearly it's written by Kissinger, if you're familiar with his writing style. But also you can see where other people quoted it and cited it under his name in the past. And all that, like it's 100% clear case that he is the guy who wrote it. So if anybody wants to find it, it's at Newsweek. And it's called New World Disorder. And so back to my old New World Order conspiracy theory, the kernel of truth in it all was that not really that they wanted to bring, not that Kissinger, I don't think ever really wanted to bring Russia into NATO, but just that they did want the United Nations Security Council to be the seat of legitimate international power in the world. And whether, you know, the intent was to evolve that into a true world federalism or not, regardless, the point was, this was the world order since World War II. And that world order accommodated the two power blocks of the East and West during communism and the Cold War. But what Kissinger was saying was, we should not be revisiting these rules. This is the deal that we have, is the UN Charter. This is what has been ratified by all these nations that are participating in it. And by doing what Dick Cheney would have done, essentially, and just ignoring the UN and going around them, he essentially was putting in jeopardy everything that Kissinger had spent his whole life working to build up. And this was the structure. This is what international law is supposed to be based on. And Bill Clinton, you know, you were mocking the phrase earlier, and it's highly and eminently mockable, the liberal rules-based international order. What that really means is the American empire. It doesn't
mean
the rule of law under even the UN charter, not that I'm endorsing it, but it doesn't mean that. It means what we say goes. That's the liberal rules-based international order. And so if the Russians have a seat on the UN Security Council and they can veto our war in Serbia, well, screw that. We'll just do it anyway. Same thing with Iraq. Russia would have vetoed the resolution to go to Iraq. So Bush just did it anyway. He got his coalition of the willing. He had the one UN Security Council resolution that says you can send the inspectors back. And then he essentially sort of pretended that that gave him authority to go to war, which is a total lie. And which, by the way, this meaningless minor technicality, Jose, didn't get a declaration of war under the U.S. Constitution either.
Yeah.
And nor did
typical.
And Bill Clinton had no authority whatsoever. At least W. Bush did get authorization from the Congress, which is not really constitutional, but it's something, where Bill Clinton just went to war on his own authority only, which he had none, zero, under the U.S. Constitution or under the U.N. Charter or the NATO Washington Treaty or anything else to launch that war. He did it on his own say-so. And Wesley Clark's willingness to obey his illegal orders was the only authority that war was based on. And then, yeah, the Russians flipped out about that at the time. They said, listen, I don't think it's really hyperbole to say, every border in Europe could be questioned, right? Every one of these was drawn by some deal makers in a room at some point. Almost none of them are the way it's always been, that this river always separated these people from those people. There's always been, you know, vast and changing. If you've ever seen, you could see like a time-lapse photo of the changing borders of Europe over the last 500 years or something. It's unbelievable, right? So the Russians said, whoa, are we now throwing into question where the lines are drawn since World War II? And that maybe we're going to settle this with violence? Because, you know, honestly, like, the most positive take on the UN Charter is that if your borders are drawn in the wrong place, let's sit down at the UN in New York and discuss this. Maybe we can come up with an accommodation. Maybe we can have a little bit of shared sovereignty in this county or that one. Or maybe we can move a line and do a little bit of a land swap. Maybe we can negotiate this and not fight. Because virtually any one of these borders could be questioned. And the Russians said, that's the fire you're playing with when you're doing this. Now, the American, it's almost like drone wars. The American attitude at the time was, well, only we have them, right? Only we can do it, and you can't do anything. So whatever, rule of law, be damned, right? But then this is the same guy who goes, oh, yeah, well, maybe I'll just have to reabsorb Eastern Ukraine then. I'm doing what you said you were doing in Kosovo, protecting an ethnic minority being oppressed in a civil war. So it doesn't mean it's perfectly true, but he at least gave him the excuse. And he also cited W. Bush's excuses about weapons of mass destruction. The Zelensky government had absolutely foolishly threatened to withdraw from the Budapest Memorandum, which was their included their agreement to forswear nuclear weapons. So Putin goes, okay, so I got the Bill Clinton precedent of an ethnic minority being persecuted in wholly within one country, but I can intervene anyway, even though no international borders have been crossed because Bill Clinton says that you can do whatever you want if you're protecting an ethnic minority. And then, oh, I got a weapons of mass destruction threat. George W. Bush said that I can do whatever I want as long as there's a threat from weapons of mass destruction. And then he goes, oh yeah. And then look, in fact, Barack Obama said in Libya that I have a responsibility to protect. Not only may I invade Ukraine, but based on this precedent, I must go save the poor people who are being persecuted. So Putin, obviously, you know, call it 60-40, 70-30, cynically invoked the cynical Clinton, Bush, and Obama excuses for their horrible, aggressive wars in Serbia, Iraq, and Libya. And then what was one of the first things that he did was he bombed the TV antenna in Kiev, which was an obvious callback, which a lot of other people noticed this, not just me, was an obvious callback to Wesley Clark bombing the TV station in Serbia, or TV in Serbia in 1999.
I want to shift back to, say, around 2010 when Viktor Yanukovych was elected president of Ukraine.
Okay.
Contrary to popular belief, especially like with hindsight and like reading a lot more material on Yanukovych, I could gather that he wasn't exactly a Russia stooge. He was kind of like one of like many post-Soviet politicians in Russia's periphery that used a so-called multi-vector foreign policy where he would try to play off Russia and then like EU and even US against each other to try to extract as many benefits as possible.
Right.
But that changed, obviously. And what do you think was like the big change in Yanukovych's presidency that caused the whole Euromaidan crisis and the first like Donbass wars and all that?
And you set it up correctly. I mean, they say, oh, this guy was just a Russian stooge. And it's not so simple. He is from the East, from the Party of Regions, which is like you could correctly identify that as like a Russian-leaning party. However, and I have to stop and recommend the citation here. I really urge your audience to look at it. I know that you'll really get a kick out of it if you haven't seen it yet, Jose. It's Paul Manafort's interview on the Patrick Bet-David show. They do this long, in-depth interview. It's from 2 years ago. And, you know, they said, people might remember, they said that Paul Manafort was a Russian spy controlling Donald Trump, right? That he's like, and if he's not a spy, then at least he's such a Russian partisan. He's the connection in the control in the Russiagate hoax of Donald Trump's supposed blackmailed subordination to Russian interests. And of course, all of that was complete hoax, but never even mind the complete hoax that they pulled on Trump. Just go back to the first part, the hoax that they pulled on Manafort. Manafort was not there to represent Russian interests whatsoever. Manafort was there representing American interests. And you can tell from the interview, he's not lying about this, man. Like, I'm sorry. It only makes perfect sense, his entire narrative and coinciding with his entire point of view about what was happening there. The way he explains it, Russia invaded in 2013. He sounds like Michael McFaul or Ann Applebaum or something. He is on Ukraine's side, on the war party side in this conflict. He is an anti-Russian guy in his basic sentiment. I mean, you go ahead and watch it and disagree with me if you can. So what was he doing? He had been hired. Okay, and I should back up. Paul Manafort is a longtime foreign government lobbyist. That him and Roger Stone and their other partners, I forgot all their names, they're known as like very slimy lobbyists for dictators and you know, pretty bad guys around the world who they don't mind. They take the money and lobby for them in Washington. Like, I think one famous example was Charles Taylor, the dictator of Liberia, whatever it was, Sierra Leone or whatever back then. And so they have a reputation of being very shady, very, very amoral or immoral, political, dirty tricksters and spinsters and consultants, right? Roger Stone, you ever seen the documentary Get Me, Roger Stone? It's something else, right? Okay, so that's who these guys are. That's their reputation. That's who Manafort is. So Manafort takes the job for Yanukovych, and the job is not move to Russia. The job is move to the European Union. Move away from Russia and toward the EU. And he explains that, and we already knew this, but he explains in the interview so well. This was already reported for people who were looking into it. But he explains so well in the interview that, you see, you have these oligarchs in eastern Ukraine who essentially are treated like the redheaded stepchild by the Russian oligarchs who use them and abuse them. And the country is so corrupt that when their guy loses the election and the other guy wins, like when, for example, Yushchenko won out in the Orange Revolution of 2004, he nationalized their companies and gave them to his friends and this kind of thing. So these Eastern Ukrainian oligarchs wanted to tilt away from Russia and to protect themselves from their political opposition inside Ukraine, mostly from the west of Ukraine. They wanted to join the EU, or at least get the process going. It was an association agreement was what was at question at the time, was sort of a half-assed EU membership. And the thinking, Manafort explains, the thinking was that if they could cozy up to the EU and get within any kind of signed contract with the EU, that would help preclude some of this most obvious and base corruption, like nationalizing your corporation and giving it to your brother-in-law, right? This kind of, or the guy's own brother-in-law, this kind of thing. So that was their motivation. That was Yanukovych's motivation. He was not a Russian slave. He was trying to move west. And he told his own, this is in Reuters, he had told his own cabinet, listen, I don't want to hear another word about we're going with Russia. Just forget it. It's over. We're doing it my way and we're moving west. But then what happened was the EU blew the negotiations. And I don't think that this was deliberate. I have no indication that like somebody sabotaged this deliberately. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying they ruined it. And no less a source than George Soros blamed it on Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, said that she drove too hard a bargain with the Ukrainians. They would have to implement severe austerity, cutting all of their subsidies for fuel prices for their citizens, cutting their pension programs and their healthcare programs for the poor and the elderly and all of this stuff, while at the same time giving them barely enough in loans to cover their interest payments on their previous loans, not really helping to put them in a position of economic strength to be able to fix their economic problems and even operate well in the EU. And you can see why, from a basic protectionist point of view, the French and the Germans are wary about bringing Ukraine into the EU, although they were trying to. But that also means a lot of competition from people who can work for lower prices, right? Mm-hmm. And who can manufacture things at lower prices, assuming a good enough investment in their productivity. And they can undermine German and French companies and German and French labor unions and these political interests who would rather not compete. And so it's always been like a kind of contentious issue about how much to bring them in and how quickly and all of that. But anyway, so what happens is, again, Soros said, that dang Angela Merkel, she blew it. She essentially played such strong arm tactics against Yanukovych while trying to get him to sign. At the same time, Putin was also playing strong arm tactics. He had publicly said, oh, I don't care if you join them. You can still have a deal with me. But apparently privately he had said no. And I think even publicly he had contradicted himself about that. We can take the worst interpretation at face value that he had threatened the Ukrainians. In fact, he was already increasing customs inspections at the border and making trade much more difficult, even, you know, in a threatening way. So Putin was really playing hardball with Yanukovych and telling him that he would do what he could to make sure that he regretted it. If Putin would do what he could to make sure Yanukovych regretted it, if he moved to the West. And then, so Yanukovych gave in to Putin. Oh, and Putin offered him like a $5 billion loan, cash straight up, like 15 total, five up front to go. And so he essentially felt he had no choice but to abandon the move toward the European Union. Now, when that happened, that was taken by, obviously, first of all, pro-EU forces, but also especially people further to the right than them, in the American, the Ukrainian nationalist right, who saw this not just as the abandonment of a promise to join up with the EU, but they saw it as a complete capitulation to Russia and the dooming of the country to be, you know, stuck under Russian influence and, you know, domination, however broadly defined, for the next term, for the next while. And so that was what kicked off the protest movement. And the guy who originally posted on Facebook, hey, everybody, let's all go to the Maidan and protest. He was from a Soros-backed media company called, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, sorry, Hamdrasky TV, which was, you know, supported by Soros. This is what they call independent media. When the Americans pour in millions of dollars, it's independent from the national government. That's that is, you know, they don't favor, but it's certainly not independent from the West. It's all sock puppetry. And what they did was, and there were, you know, huge crowds of people turned out and everything. No one can deny that. But the Americans turned out huge quantities of dollars to support the whole thing as well. Just like in 2004, they spent probably hundreds of millions, certainly tens of millions of dollars, high tens of millions of dollars, and in cooperation with NATO allies as well, to support the movement out in the protest movement out there. So they got to keep people fed. They got to have porta potties. They've got to have entertainment and electricity and warm places to sleep. They brought in these, I think this goes back to 04, but same difference, that our tax dollars paid for these polystyrene foam boards that are these thin, somewhat stiff, but like somewhat flexible, I guess, type of rubber board that insulate from the cold. So you can lay them down on the cold ground and still get your sleeping bag and lay down on the thing. And it'll really insulate you from the cold ground and in freezing and sub-freezing temperatures all through that winter, through, you know, December and January and February of 2013 and into 14. And so all that takes a ton of money. And all that essentially was to increase the tension and force Yanukovych to agree to let all of his opponents come and take over his government. And, but in that agreement that he finally did give into, he agreed to pull his police back if the protesters would pull their armed forces back. But that was absolute idiotic mistake. And apparently his security forces saw that as, oh, and he also promised to investigate the shootings on the Maidan, which, you know, the famous sniper shootings, which are partially still unsolved. Some of them are not. I mean, there's a lot of shootings here that day, but the actual sniping of both sides, a lot of that really remains unsolved. But both sides, of course, accuse the other of, you know, trying to heighten tensions with the thing. But anyway, in the deal, he promised to investigate that, which apparently his security forces read as his intention to throw them under the bus and blame them for doing the wrong thing. So they left town, and then the junior officers saw that and said, or like the junior, you know, security forces saw the leaders leave town. They all got on buses and left town too. So they didn't just withdraw their forces from the Maidan. They left the capital. And at that point, it was, and I know people get all just retarded emotions about this, but it's just true. It was Hitler-loving neo-Nazis who led the putsch, who had announced the night before, if he's not gone by 10 a.m., we're going to kill him. And that's in the New York Times and everything else too. You can read it in, you know, the German press and read it in, hell, even in, you know, the Kiev Post and whatever. They all talk about it. And it was the guy's name is Parisyuk, who was the leader of the snipers from the music conservatory the morning before that had killed all the cops and bragged about it and admitted it. He was the same guy who ran up there and said, if the president's not gone by 10 a.m., I'm going to kill him. I swear to God. And the crowd says, yes, yes, let's do it. And then he ended up becoming a member of parliament. You know, that was what did it. So in fact, it's a little bit wrong when people say it was a coup, because what it was is, I don't know French, but it was not a coup d'etat, which usually means like the general kills the president and replaces him or arrests him and replaces him. This was a street putsch, right? This was a right-wing, P-U-S-T-C-H. This was a right-wing street putsch, or essentially a riot, a January 6th style riot, only brought all the way to fruition and forced the guy to leave. And then, as was thoroughly documented at the time, the first thing they did was start painting swastikas everywhere and SS runes and Confederate battle flags, which, look, I was raised on the Dukes of Hazzard, but there are white supremacists who use that flag to mean it in the way that the worst liberals accuse. And this is the Kiev City Hall, right? They're decorating it with Nazi and Confederate memorabilia, Celtic crosses, yes, and all this stuff, and declaring victory for Hitler on the day that they won.
Yeah, we're approaching like the time limit now, but real quick, just like cliff notes, what do you think were the final like sticking points that prompted Russia to ultimately carry out like a much harder invasion of Ukraine in 2022? You say
the first thing was the ongoing civil war in the East and the absolute refusal of the U.S. to influence Ukraine to implement the Minsk II deal to bring the fighting to an end. And they had already agreed to the deal, and then they just took it back and refused to implement it. The next major issue was NATO expansion and the further and further integration of Ukraine into NATO's military force. Again, the worst of both worlds. We make them a de facto member, but without that war guarantee. Not that I'm arguing for the war guarantee, but I'm just saying we shouldn't have been arming them up then, because we're making them a target, but without the disincentive to beat them up, right? Like, and then the other one was missile defense systems, which they put in Romania and Poland, and which Putin repeatedly said, and I think sincerely, that he was concerned the Americans would try to put anti-ballistic missile systems in Kharkiv, right there adjacent to Russia, and that this either is meant to provide for a first strike capability or an increase in a first strike capability, in the sense that if we launch a first strike, then with missile defense, we're possibly implying that we believe the capability, that we have the capability to shoot down anything that they have left in a to launch in a retaliatory strike, thus canceling mutually assured destruction, making their trigger finger that much itchier, making the situation that much more dangerous. Now, the real thing of it here is, one, Biden was never going to implement Minsk II, so just put that aside. The low-level war was going to continue no matter what. But Biden said that we're not going to bring them into NATO anytime soon. And what missiles? We're not putting missiles in Kharkiv. And I have to tell you, I think that was sincere. But he wasn't willing to put it in writing. He was only willing to say it on a phone call and not make a treaty, because that would be giving in to Hitler and all this stuff that you can never do. And so they chose instead to launch the war. And then once the war started, they said, oh yeah, see, actually our brilliant plan is strategic defeat of Russia by prolonging the war and bankrupting them over the long term. Remember, they even said they thought Putin's government would fall and he would be replaced by Americans next. Yeah. So that's kind of how they rationalized what they had done, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, this is just like a total mess, but just like one final point here. Do you see like the incoming Trump administration using like some like magical art of the deal type of like negotiating strategy to bring this to an end, or will it just continue?
I think it's very difficult. The Ukrainians and therefore the Americans are in a position of weakness. The Russians can take the run of the table if they want. You know, Wesley Clark in that interview said, oh, we just got to give them more weapons or whatever. I didn't get a chance to explain how, like, no, they don't have the men. It doesn't matter. Hey, we'd have to give them destroyers and B-52s, man, and then we're at war with Russia. That's what it would take to reverse the tide with a new weapons system. So essentially, they're screwed. And this is the real tough thing. Donald Trump is going to need our support if he really wants to seek peace, because the narrative is going to be that he's stabbing them in the back and leaving them high and dry. And Jose, it's true. It's just not his fault. It's Joe Biden's fault for making promises he couldn't keep and getting them into this trouble. It's the same as Trump did the right thing to make a deal to leave Afghanistan. It wasn't ever going to work. So I'm sorry, but those are the breaks. And that has to be the sentiment among the American people. We are sorry that Biden got you in this trouble, but we support our president now trying to end it. And that must be the narrative from the American right, especially right now.
Well, a very tricky situation, to say the least. But before we go our separate ways, Scott, where can Barnes Review listeners keep up with your latest work?
The book is on sale at Amazon. If you stop by my website, scotthorton.org first, I'll get a little extra kickback from the link there. But otherwise, it's on Amazon in paperback and Kindle. And I will be doing an audiobook podcast series first from scotthortonshow.com. And that'll be starting here real soon.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. And for the Barnes History Hour, this is Jose Nino signing out.